and this is Cincinnati Edition. On 91.7 WVXU, I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati's rich film history dates all the way back to 1903. That's when Mills Edisonia opened on Fountain Square. This amusement parlor housed 140 electric motion picture machines, and it was the first permanent location in Cincinnati devoted to exhibiting moving pictures. In the years that followed, Cincinnati would be home to many iconic theaters, including the Regal, the Imperial, and the Emory, as well as movie stars Theda Bara, Doris Day, and Tyrone Power. The Public Library of Cincinnati in Hamilton County explores the Queen City's cinematic past in the exhibit, Cinema Cincinnati. It runs through January 26th at the Downtown Main Library. Theater historian Hank Sykes will be giving a talk, Lost and Found Theaters of the Queen City, tonight at 7 p.m. in the Genealogy and Local History Program space. And joining me now is theater historian Hank Sykes. Hank, thanks for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you very much for the invite.
We also have Gary Goldman. He is the general manager of the Esquire, Marymount, and Kenwood Theaters. His family has an extraordinary history to local movie theaters. Gary, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for asking me to be here.
And also joining us is Brian Powers. He's a reference librarian at the Public Library of Cincinnati and Hamilton County. Brian, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right. The first question that I want to ask, even though we're talking about movie theaters, is, you know, driving around in our neighborhood where WVXU is right here in the West End, you see this building at Liberty and Central with Warner Brothers on it. And you think there's never really any Hollywood production activity going on there. What is the connection? Why is there this Warner Brothers building right in the heart of Cincinnati? And Hank and Gary and Brian, I'm hoping that you all can answer this. Hank, what kind of information can you give us?
Well, some locals think that movies were made there. One of the reasons that it's located where it is in the early days, all of the film was nitrate film, which means it was explosive. And the film exchanges were right down around Opera Place, which is where, kind of opposite Fountain Square, and it's where Batsack's hat shop is down there, okay? That area was also surrounded by tenements. The fire departments were not too crazy about having all of that volatile film.
A fire hazard. Which,
yes, that's right. So eventually, I think with pleading, they moved many of the exchanges out to this area here.
Okay. I'm not even sure what an exchange is.
An exchange is you own a theater. You have to have film every day to run. You don't have time to contact the studios constantly. So the studios are going to ship to an exchange, and the exchange will then deliver, or you will go and get from them, the individual cans of film that put the show on the screen for you.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So they make money, and some of that money goes to Hollywood. Today, a lot of it goes to Hollywood, and the concession stands are really what help keep a lot of theaters in business today.
So then the exchange was its own operation? Was it its own, like there were business entities that solely operated exchanges?
Oh, sure. There would have been, there would have been people there who repaired film, who lined up the cans you want to get for the show you're going to put on the screen.
And Gary, we were talking a little bit before we started that Warner Brothers building wasn't the only one where this was going on in town. There were some other buildings that did similar work?
There were several buildings on Central Parkway there that were film exchanges. And I remember when I was very young and we would open films every 3 days at the theater.
And you're talking about the Regal Theater.
The Regal Theater. My dad would take me to the exchanges because that's where a lot of the deals were made for which films you were going to play next.
Gary, were you first run?
Yes.
Okay.
But when, you know, first, you know, the multiplexes started showing up in the neighborhoods, and then the single screen theaters downtown started to disappear, and then the national chains started to come in, and first run kind of took on a new nature because a lot of the independent pictures would be prohibited from playing some of the films they wanted to play.
So they could get exclusive rights to it, and then they would have all access to it, and the other ones would be forced to show something that maybe
people didn't want to see. In the suburbs, too, in some cases, the smaller theaters would be second run, and there were even some cities where you had third runs, which you could barely see the print by the time it hit the screen, could
you? When you say second run and third run, what does that mean?
It means that, let's say, Gary had an exclusive first-run movie at his theater for a few days, and eventually it would be sent out to the suburbs. That was called second run. It was also, I think it would also be a little cheaper, too, wouldn't it?
It would be, in a way the film companies would keep the second-run theaters from playing first-run product was they would say, well, you can charge whatever you want, but we want a per capita. For everyone who comes through the door, we want $3.50 or a percentage, whichever is greater. So if your ticket structure was below that per capita, you would lose money on every ticket. So if you were a sub-run theater playing at a reduced admission, that kept you from playing the first-run pictures.
Oh, wow. This history is fascinating, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the other historical components, but we've all gathered here because of an exhibit and a talk that's coming to the library. In fact, the exhibit itself is already open, an exhibit celebrating the Queen City cinematic history called Cinema Cincinnati. Brian, what is this? What will people see when they come down to the library to check this out?
Well, it's an exhibit celebrating Cincinnati's cinematic history. It's really mostly photos because that's what we mostly have, but it's sort of a timeline of theaters throughout the Cincinnati area, starting from the earlier Nickelodeons that were on Fifth Avenue, like around the early 1900s, going to the big palaces that were built in the 20s, getting into the neighborhood theaters that were built in the 30s and 40s, the drive-ins, the art house theaters that came into and a little bit on the multiplexes, a little bit, but it comes up until modern times and people who are still involved doing things with theater in the Cincinnati area.
Okay, so when you talk about coming into modern times, what are the types of theaters that stand out in this collection?
Well, I mean, and currently, I mean, there's like, most recently, I mean, of course, the Esquire, which Gary is general manager, they've been around since 1919 showing art house theater stuff. Full disclosure, I used to work at the Esquire.
What, did you make popcorn?
I was an assistant manager. I used to work for Gary.
Oh, cool.
And he survived it?
Yes. And I went to work with the movies downtown when that existed. And so before I worked at the library, I used to work at theaters. I worked at a theater back in Virginia. So it's kind of in my blood. So it was one of the reasons I was interested in doing this.
But there's not a lot of theaters like the Esquire anymore, or the Marymount, that have sort of that classic look and that long history, you know. And even the ones that I grew up with, like the Showcase over off I-75 and Earth, that's now gone, right. You know, like everything's changed.
Yeah. But there are groups that are around, like there's the Mini Micro Theater, which opened up on Main Street. So it's obviously smaller things, but there are people who are passionate about film who are doing stuff. There's the Cincinnati Film Society. So a little shout out to some of those people who want to do film events and things like that, like the Cinema Guerrilla guys who have the restaurant-themed restaurants, you know, stuff like that.
So this exhibit runs through January 26th. Mm-hmm. And on Wednesday, November 6th, Hank, you're giving a presentation called The Lost and Found Theaters.
Yeah, my big mouth runs.
Yeah.
Let's hope I can remember something.
I have a feeling you can.
Open it.
Lost and Found Theaters of the Queen City. I'm intrigued that it's lost and found because you really can find yourself in one of our urban areas in this region and not realize you're walking past what used to be a very popular cinematic destination.
And reused as many different things over the years.
Yeah, so give us a little taste of what your presentation's going to be.
Well, you'll start. Brian found the opening ad in 1903 for the Mills Edisonia that came out of Chicago. That was on Fountain Square, about where the Fifth Third Bank is today. And 1908, out from Pittsburgh, comes Ike Lipson. Ike Lipson was the manager and owner of the Bijou Theater. He came from Pittsburgh because Pittsburgh had the very first theater named the Nickelodeon. There were other theaters showing films, but they coined the phrase Nickelodeon. Nickel because of the price of admission, and Odeon is the Greek word for theater, of course. Unless you go to England and you go to the Odeon Theater, and then you're going to theater. I guess that's the way that would work.
That's very interesting.
They The Nickelodeon craze catered to, in the early days, of course, it was silent. And we've been through sound. We've been through black and white film, color film. And now we don't even have dear film. We have digital. And about in the early days, film was considered, you kind of didn't want to be seen going into a Nickelodeon. It was, it didn't get the classiest group of people. In a lot of cases, it didn't get English-speaking people because they were silent. You could tell, you, even if you couldn't read the titles, there were titles on the screen. You could, the stories were fairly simple, so you could tell where they were going to go. And about 1914, you had perhaps the largest number of Nickelodeons by then.
In Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, where were they?
Well, a lot of them were on West 5th Street. Some of them were going down, I was going to say Vine Street. Yes, I guess you could say that because the Capitol was on Vine. The Capitol eventually ran Cinerama many, many years after that. In the downtown area, just for theaters alone, and many of them started as legitimate houses. On Vine Street, if you started at 5th, you walked down and you went by the Lyric Theater. Next to that would have been the Family Theater. Across the street was the Grand and the Gifts. And the Gifts had been a firehouse. And it was named Gifts because the city had run out of money and they asked for the public to donate money to build this firehouse. So they named it the Gifts. When the when they didn't need the firehouse anymore, Jackson and McMahon, who were film distributors and exhibitors, they moved in, gutted it, and established the Gifts Theater there. And further down the street, you'd have the little Royal Theater about 1907. Across the street from that, you'd have the Capitol. And if you went up 7th Street and went east, you would go by the little Cox Theater, which was built by Mrs. Cox as a memorial to George B. Cox.
Of the Cox political family.
That's correct. And about 1914, Mr. Cox became the president of the World Film Company, and his partners were the Schuberts.
Wow.
So next to the Cox was the Schubert Theater. No big surprise there.
Certainly not.
If you crossed Walnut Street, still on 7th, you have the Olympic parking garage today. In 1904, 1905, and certainly 1906, that would have been the Olympic Theater. And if you look up at the top of the parking sign over there, you see it says, since 1929. That's because in 1929, the theater was torn down and the parking garage was built there, which is very nice because it looks like a business building. And I think they did that on purpose so it blended in with other structures in the area. You had the Walnut Theater on Walnut Street coming up. You had the Strand Theater, which was named the Gaiety originally. And during World War II, from 41 to about 40, late 45, that was the Telenews Theater. You went to see newsreels. Sometimes in the war years, theaters ran films because you had three and four shifts of war working people. The only, I couldn't find that running all night, but I did find the last show at the Telenews was 11:13, and I suspect, and that would have been about an hour newsreel that you got. Eventually, after the war, it went back to being the Strand again. In about 1965, that was torn down when they were developing Fountain Square.
Well, how were, with this high concentration of theaters in one central business district, how were they able to differentiate from each other? How were they able to compete and draw the audiences that they wanted?
Well, so the seating capacity in those, the biggest theater, the Albee, would have been 3,000, and that's a single screen. You know what it sounded like when you watched a comedy with 3,000 people? It was wonderful. It was. Some of the other theaters, like the Palace, which would have been on 6th Street, they would seat about 2,200, and that was about 1919 when that was built. And then you had other, most theaters, the biggest theaters were 2,000 seats, some of them down to 8,000. In that area there. The little ones on 5th Street West 5th Street to distinguish it from East 5th Street, of course, were much smaller houses. They'd be 300-400
So they were really of varying sizes, although there were so many. But they're,
and varying prices.
Exactly. And that is Hank Sykes you've been listening to. He'll be giving a presentation called Lost and Found Theaters of the Queen City. He is a local film historian. And we're also joined by Gary Goldman, who is currently the general manager of the Esquire Marymount and Kenwood Theaters. But your family's relationship with local movie theaters goes back way earlier than you. Tell us about the Regal Theater and your family's connection to that.
Well, the Regals, my grandfather, Jack Goldman, had four theaters in Cincinnati in the early 40s and late 30s. And he actually won the Regal in a lawsuit because the other theaters were leased and he had a non-compete clause. And whoever owned the Regal at the time breached that clause, and he took him to court and won the Regal in a lawsuit.
Wow.
So it turned out to be the only theater that we actually owned instead of leased.
So he had operated some theaters without being the owner of them. So he knew the business.
Right. He had four other theaters.
Okay. And what year was this? When did...
This had to be the late 30s.
Wow. Okay. And so being a movie theater family, and did your father...
So my father worked in the... theater business. He got out of the Navy probably in the late 40s and joined the business. My grandfather's brother worked in the business, and my uncle also worked in the business. It was a family affair.
So outside of movies, what role did the Regal play in the community here in the West End?
Oh, there's so many stories. We had stage shows at the Regal. Not when I say we, I mean my family. It was before my time. I guess I was born, but I wasn't involved in it. But my grandfather would bring in national acts. He had Lionel Hampton and Sammy Davis Jr. with his uncle and his dad, and Sugar Child Robinson and Butter Beans and Susie. And these would all be midnight shows, and is wildly popular.
As these theaters are preserved and continue to attract people, what are your thoughts about the loss of some of these historic buildings and these historic theaters, Hank?
Well, if you go to Cleveland, you have five original theaters from the 20s. And they managed to keep them running, but it takes a special, strong person to begin to do that. Yes, we lost a lot of our theaters downtown. I thought one of the most interesting theaters that I looked up was you had a German language theater. And the theater itself still exists today, but you've never seen it. But you have seen it, kind of.
Okay.
When you go to the Taft Theater.
Yeah.
When you use the exit over on the left-hand side, if you've been seated in the theater, you come up a long corridor. And generally they have records, beer mugs, bottle openers, whatever it is that they're selling. Behind that wall is the original UFA Theater. That's out of Berlin. It was as large in production as MGM was out in the Hollywood area.
Wow.
That existed from, and they showed only German language films because of the large population of Germans here. That existed from about 1931 to about 35, I think. That's when Mr. A. Hitler began to misbehave himself over in Europe. They closed the UFA and it became the Mayfair Hall and showed travelogues, operas, smaller independent films. That existed probably until about 1950 or so, and then it became a meeting hall for the Seventh-day Adventists, Christian Scientists. Today, I guess you can still rent it for weddings and bar mitzvahs and receptions, whatever you want. It was 400 seats. Today, it is pews for 250 people.
Wow. I had no idea about that.
But unchanged, completely Moorish in design, with rookwood tile on the side walls. Very nice.
The name of the event is Cinema Cincinnati, an exhibit celebrating the Queen City's cinematic history. It is showing through January 26 at the Downtown Library. And if you want to catch one of our guests His name is Hank Sykes. He'll be giving a presentation, Lost and Found Theaters of the Queen City. That's Wednesday, November 6th at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Main Library. My thanks to you, Hank Sykes. Thanks for coming down. Gary Goldman from the Esquire Kenwood and Marymount Theaters for being here as well. And from the Main Library, the reference librarian there, Brian Powers. Thanks so much for coming down and chatting with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.